Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, playwright Amy Fried and director Art Mankey talk about The Monster Builder at the Aurora Theater. Carrie Paff and Gabe Marin share details about Stage Kiss, a romantic comedy at the San Francisco Playhouse. Broadway star James Snyder will talk about his role in the touring production of If Then, currently at the Orpheum. Stacey Garup and Bob Geary talk about the San Francisco Choral Society's next concert. Plus, contributor Peter Robinson muses on the month of November. Stay with us. The San Francisco Playhouse will continue its 13th main stage season with the Bay Area premiere of Sarah Ruhl's Valentine to the Theater, Stage Kiss, directed by co-founder of the Playhouse, Susie Damolano. Two of the featured actors join me in studio for return appearances on KALW's Open Air, Gabriel Marin and Carrie Paff. Carrie was seen recently in the terrific SF Playhouse productions of Stupid Effing Bird and Ideation. She's also been seen in leading roles at the ACT, Aurora Theater, Marin Theater, Magic, Edinburgh Fringe Festival, among many others. She's also worked extensively as a teaching artist and arts education activist as co-founder of StageRight, a successful nonprofit organization which uses theater to build literacy with inner-city elementary school children. Carrie, always a pleasure to have you back on our airways.
Thanks so much for having me.
Gabe Marin makes his home in Berkeley and has been an MVP on the Bay Area theater scene for some two decades or so. By night, the charismatic actor takes on roles everywhere from the San Francisco Playhouse to the Aurora Theater Company, among others. Terrific in Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, which we talked about here on the air recently. And by day, he's a superhero of a different type as marketing director for Walnut Creek's Center Repertory Company. Gabe, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, Stage Kiss. This has got to have all kinds of interesting implications as actors on the stage. Let's hear about the plot line first, and then we'll talk about some personal experiences. Who wants to handle the plot?
Oh, my goodness. Well, yeah. The whole thing, it starts with an audition. I'm auditioning for a 1930s melodrama. So my main character throughout the play is an actor in New York, modern day right now. And I get cast in this 1930s melodrama, which was a flop on Broadway, but they're remounting it and hoping to make a big hit. And this is I'm auditioning for the out-of-town tryout in New Haven. So we go through all the rehearsals of the 1930 melodrama, but the trick is that on the first day of rehearsal, I find out that I am cast opposite my lover from 20 years ago. We were together for 6 years from when we were 18 to 24, and he was the love of my life, and it ended very, very nastily.
Emphasis on the was.
Yeah. And we haven't seen each other since first rehearsal.
Oh, my gosh.
Except I've been stalking him and watching all of his plays, but I've never ever said hello in all these 20 years. And I've retired from the theater, and so I'm coming back. I've been out of the theater for 10 years. I'm coming back, and so we do this show. And that's the first act, is getting up to opening night of this show and what's going on with our relationship as
so,
it progresses.
So, well, at least these characters are familiar with each other's mouths.
Yes, very. Perhaps too much becomes a bit of an issue in rehearsal.
Well, let's talk about the rehearsal process and the degree of just general in kissing among actors. Is that something that has a certain ick factor, or is it part of the game?
Well, it depends on who you're cast against. You
know? Right.
Sometimes it's the worst part of your job, and sometimes it's like, oh, there are perks to being an actor. Yeah, the pay's not good, but
I mean, it's obviously very intimate, but it is part of the job. You know, and it's part of the dance that we learn to do. But Yeah, it really depends on who you're cast opposite. That makes a big difference.
And I think that it's actually a lot easier for Gabe and I because we have worked together so many times. We've done 6 full productions together. We've done films. We've done readings. We're, for some reason, cast opposite each other a lot.
Uh-huh.
And for the past 8 years, we've been consistently working opposite each other. So it's not so terrifying and awful that first time you go in for that first kiss in rehearsal. You're like, okay, we can do this. We're not going to freak out all the way.
That was a big part of my being able to accept the play was the fact that Carrie and I have worked together and opposite each other so much over the last decade. Because there's a lot of kissing in the show.
Like,
there's
a lot.
Like, a lot.
Well, I'm going to see Die Meistersinger von Nuremberg at the SF Opera, which is like a 5.5 hour long production, hoping there's like a coffee sponsor for that. Now, is there maybe a Listerine sponsor for SF Playhouse for you guys?
There should be. We are going through the Altoids. I kiss almost everyone in the play, actually. I don't kiss the director, who's the director in the play, but I kiss pretty much everyone else, I think. And yeah, the Altoids are going fast and loose.
Almost everybody in the show kisses somebody, and so there's a lot of emergency and other vitamin C supplements going on, because if somebody gets sick, we are all going down.
Oh my, that's true. I mean, that's the reality of it all.
Yeah.
So everybody's very much trying to stay healthy. So.
Well, Carrie, you told us about the first act. Gabe, maybe you can share some details about the second act.
Well, without giving away too much, I think one of the interesting things about this play structurally is that the narrative that you're following is these two former first loves and their relationship working together under these circumstances. What's kind of interesting, I found, is that the circumstances that surround them, the plays within the plays, and the scenes between them, kind of is a little bit like a fever dream in their logic. And time is compressed, and a lot of other naturalistic devices.
There's some amazing surreal elements,
yeah,
which Sarah Rule uses a lot, and in this play she uses them at very unexpected moments where suddenly we burst into song and we kind of go into this dream state, and that happens throughout.
And it's a lot of life imitating art and art imitating life, and so much so that in one particular place, and I don't think I'm giving out too much, but the one person's actual apartment is the identical set for a play within the play that they do, and that they've modeled this off of what is. So yeah, and then the plays within the plays are echoing completely what's happening in real life. I think that's part of the fun of this fun play.
And being described as not only fun but a wry romantic comedy. Tell us a little bit about Sarah's writing and what she pulls in that just makes you say, "You nailed it, Sarah."
What's so amazing about her in general, I think, but especially in this play, is the absolute fearlessness in melding crazy, ridiculous comedy, even physical slapstick comedy, with like the most incredible, heartfelt, real stuff. We are going back and forth all the time in style in this play, from this 1930s style to present day rehearsal hall, and then to this very gritty New York play, which is the other play in the second act. With very down on their luck characters having a very gritty time. But her writing is just, she's not afraid of just being completely open-heartedly present and giving that to the audience and the characters as like, let's talk about what you're really feeling and not just talk around it and not just in poetry, but actually this is this real, real moment happening right now at the same time that she's doing this magical flights of fancy.
Were either of you familiar with Sarah's work before?
As an audience member, but I hadn't ever been in anything of hers. I loved Eurydice at Berkeley Rep. Was when I first fell in love with her, that Charlie Robinson was in. It was incredible.
Hmm. Unfortunately, this is my first entry point into her work and her world.
Your first kiss, so to speak.
My first kiss, so to speak. Exactly.
Well, you know, we talked about how comfortable you guys are with acting with each other. I wonder if you could each share, you know, without naming names.
Oh, my gosh.
Share with us perhaps a bad theatrical stage kiss experience.
Wow.
Oh, you have to be so careful.
Yeah, I don't generally kiss and tell.
Well, you don't have to tell names, but just, something that was awfully good or awfully bad?
Well, okay. Well, my longtime partner is an actress, and we finally got cast opposite each other, and we had to kiss, and she was very excited about this. And so when the time finally came, we finally had our big stage kiss. I remember your reaction was like, "What was that? What the?" And, you know, I'm like, look, you know, going through our minds, there's so many different things of, like, what we have to do right after the kiss and, you know, whether there's a slap involved or what have you. And you're thinking about so many other things that you might otherwise not be thinking, hopefully, when you're in private. So I guess in that respect, I was the bad kiss. I think I was, in one case, trying to just make sure that my fake mustache stayed on my face. But
how about you, Carrie?
Oh, I've definitely had both ends of the spectrum. I have had experiences where I can tell that the guy does not want to kiss me, and that's a bummer. And there's just like kind of a turning off and a turning away and like, all right, I'll get through this. And that's pretty demoralizing, just kind of have to go get through that somehow. And then I've had the opposite where not to name any names, this was a long time ago, but I had a co-star who wanted to warm up in the wings before we went on stage for the scene. So I had to put a stop to that. So yeah, you get both sides.
Wow. That's
lack great. Of interest and over-interest.
Well, that kind of brings up an interesting point. I mean, as a professional actor, you're still doing what is, you know, could be a very erotic, arousing act on stage. And so body parts have to be kept in check, in other words.
And you can't divorce yourself completely from the reality of it.
Right.
That's not the point. Like, I'm kissing, but it's just like being, you know, doing a hammering or something. Like, you have to actually be there and be in that moment so that it's affecting the play and what happens. You just have to translate it so that it's your character who's feeling any wonderful feelings you might be having.
But at the same time, there's the artistry of it. And one of my favorite acting teachers, who actually it was also the teacher of another one of our castmates, always talked about the kiss, and I always remember this, is that what makes a great kiss, and the ones that we've seen, is not necessarily the kiss itself, but it's that moment right before the kiss, and it's the moment right after the kiss that makes it a great kiss artistically. So there's that element as well.
And if it's too great, you can still have to remember your next line. That's got to be...
Right, and we have some moments in this play where our characters are calling line after we kiss.
That's Gabe Marin. He and Carrie Paff are two of the stars of Stage Kiss by Sarah Rule. It's at the San Francisco Playhouse, directed by Susie Damolano, now through January 9th. Information at sfplayhouse.org. Thanks, guys, for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And I look forward to seeing the show.
Remember this, a kiss is still a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say, I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate, that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
The great Jimmy Durante with his own stage kiss to send off stage kiss at the San Francisco Playhouse. Good afternoon, David Not to Leave here for Open Air. Still to come, we'll be talking with Broadway star James Snyder about his role in If Then at the Orpheum. Plus, we'll hear about the Monster Builder at the Aurora Theater. But next, a discussion with Bob Geary and Stacey Garrup about the San Francisco Choral Society's upcoming concert. A pleasure to welcome back Maestro Bob Geary to our airwaves. Bob is also co-founder of Volte and the Piedmont Boys and Girls Choirs, director of the Golden Gate International Children's Choral Festival, as well as, I believe, since its inception, is that right, the San Francisco Choral Society?
No, Choral Society, it's been 20 years, so there were a few. It was founded by Adrian Horn, and Megan Solomon did a brief stint with them, and Bruce Lamont did a brief stint, but I got there and they haven't managed to force me out yet, so
we're having a good time. Well, welcome back to you, Bob.
Thank you.
He's joined by Stacey Garrup, also back to our airwaves. Not sure what kind of music I should have brought to introduce you with. We'll hear some of your own music shortly. Stacey grew up in the East Bay and now lives in Chicago, where she teaches at Roosevelt University's Chicago College of Performing Arts. A highly lauded composer has been commissioned and performed by, among many others, the Minnesota Orchestra, the Albany Symphony, Chanticleer, Chicago A Cappella, and the Capitol Saxophone Quartet. Her multi-part oratorio entitled Terra Nostra for chorus, children's chorus, string orchestra, piano, percussionists, and soloists is a co-commission by the San Francisco Choral Society and the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir and is featured in its entirety this weekend. An all-Garrup CD called Mythology Symphony, which we'll hear shortly, is due for release tomorrow. Stacey, welcome to you.
It's great to be here.
Well, you were last here to talk about Terra Nostra Part 2, The Rise of Humanity. Refresh our collective addled brain about the origins and background of the project and how you and Bob met.
When did we meet?
Yeah. We met, I think, in early commissions of Volte for some sonnets.
Around 2002 or 2003.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I'm a fan of Stacey's. She writes in a wonderfully rich, well-composed style that's emotionally very appealing and accessible. And when the Choral Society, which I am so thrilled about, you know, mustered up the resources and has the forward-looking attitude to undertake a full-scale oratorio, Stacey was a natural choice for composer. And the way we're phasing it in, I think, has been just a terrific way to develop it along the ways, and now the world premiere coming up this weekend. So I'm thrilled. Maybe you want to speak a little bit to that, too.
Well, the way this actually played out is I was the composer in residence of the Volte High School
Choral Institute.
Institute many years ago. And at the Institute, Bob asked me if I were to write an oratorio, what would it be about? And I think it took about a day before I came back with the idea of about Mother Earth. And this is partially because I'd just written a string quartet about the same subject, and I felt like this is something I could go on a lot longer about and do a bigger statement. But from that moment, that was several years ago, I actually drafted a proposal, which Bob gave to the San Francisco Choral Society Board. And then eventually, about, I don't know, 8 months later, they approved it. So then it went to the stage of looking for texts. And then finally, after that, I had cleared time in my schedule from teaching so that I could compose for 8 months straight. And that's when the whole thing got written.
Nice. And now being performed in its entirety.
Yes.
That's great.
And it was very helpful hearing it, part one last November and part two last April, partially because I could make adjustments along the way. If I was hearing that I wrote something maybe a little too challenging for the choir or something was not really balanced with the orchestra, I could fix all that for the round that you're going to hear this weekend.
Nice. A rather ambitious overall arching theme behind the oratorio then.
Yes, very much. This is something that I've... As the process went on, I originally had a lot of other texts I was hoping to incorporate into the oratorio, but certain people wouldn't give me permission to use texts, and other ones did. So this is the course that it has taken. And I feel like of all the texts that are in here, we've got Walt Whitman, a ton of Walt Whitman, actually, and Percy Shelley. But the gist of the whole thing for me is a poem by Wendell Berry. and it's called The Want of Peace. And it comes at a very strong moment in the oratorio where the whole world is out of kilter, the choir is screaming up there, the orchestra is screaming, and then everything quiets down, and it's just the choir and strings singing The Want of Peace by Wendell Berry.
Mm. We don't have an excerpt of the music right now, but I'm wondering, could you share the poem with us?
Sure. here it is. All goes back to the earth, and so I do not desire pride of excess or power, but the contentments made by men who have little, the fisherman's silence receiving the river's grace, the gardener's musings on rose. I lack the peace of simple things. I am never wholly in place. I find no peace or grace. We sell the world to buy fire, our way lighted by burning men, and that has bent my mind and made me think of darkness and wish for the dumb life of roots.
Mm-hmm. Some prose that's going to be set by Stacey Garup as part of the large work, the Oratorio Terra Nostra, this weekend, Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 4 at the First Unitarian Church on Franklin and Geary, the San Francisco Choral Society, under the direction of my other guest, Bob Geary. Stacey, you've also written and had some of your music performed by Volti, Bob's other ensemble. One of Bob's other ensembles, I should say. What's the difference in writing for a group like the Choral Society, which is a large part of very excellent amateurs, and mm-hmm. the smaller ensemble of folks that are involved in Volti?
It's a very different experience. You're writing for, you know, at least 100, 120, 140 voices are going to be singing this music, and you know it's going to be accompanied by an orchestra. The main concern when I put this piece together is that for all the rehearsals that the choirs had, we only have 2 rehearsals to put everything together with both choirs, the 4 soloists, and the orchestra.
Wow.
So that became the overriding concern the entire time I wrote it is, am I writing something that's easily navigatable to put together in maybe, 2.5, 3 hours tops? Mm-hmm. And the piece is 70 minutes.
Mm-hmm. That's where Bob comes in, herding the cats.
we're kind of used to that model. Most choral societies, community choruses, have that model where they can prepare for 2 or 3 months for a performance and then bring the orchestra in at the end. But it does mean a lot has to happen very efficiently at the end. But we had a great dress rehearsal on Tuesday, and we have 1 more rehearsal tomorrow. Everything is looking great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, for part 2 last April, Stacey's music was paired with Handel. For these concerts, American composer and National Medal of Arts recipient Morten Lauridsen is also represented on the program. Bob, can you tell us a little bit about him and about Lux Aeterna, which will be performed
sure.
this weekend?
Yeah, this is Morten Lauridsen's signature work. I mean, he is considered the most widely performed choral composer in the United States, I think, or has been for some years. He just struck a chord sort of literally with a particular harmonic idea that he uses a lot that really reaches out to people. It's very empathetic. Lux Aeterna was a piece he assembled using some of the Latin text from the Requiem and other texts in memory of his own mother. And it's a very kind of consoling, healing piece of music that is quite cathartic both to perform and to hear. And like I say, he's had great success with it globally. He did receive the National Medal of the Arts, I think it's called. One of those Kennedy Center presentations that we see on the television from time to time. So he's really highly regarded. His music is all informed by his roots in the San Juan de Fuca Straits on the islands up there, the San Juan Islands. And there, having visited him up there on a very remote island a couple of times, there's just a peace and a space calmness that permeates his music also. So, yeah, it's a fine piece and happy to be doing it again. And also it programmatically kind of continues. Stacey raises some very significant concerns in her large work about the earth, and somehow the Lauridsen balances out it a little bit. Balances it out a little bit.
Very nice. Yeah. Concerts once again of Terra Nostra, the complete oratorio by Stacey Garup, and Lauridsen's Lux Aeterna at the First Unitarian Church this Saturday at 8, Sunday at 4. the Unitarian Churches at Franklin and Geary. For more information, you go to sfchoral.org. Stacy, I'd like to go out with some music of yours. You've got a CD release tomorrow. The new CD is called Mythology Symphony. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what we're going to hear in that first movement.
So this is by Sadie Records. You can go to Sadie Records website, and Sadie is spelled C-E-D-I-L-L-E, and then Records. Not at all how it sounds.
I was going to say Cedilla.
I wrote a mythology symphony about female Greek characters, and the first movement is about Medusa. It's called Becoming Medusa because the piece is actually both how she's beautiful and she becomes a gorgon, this ugly, hideous gorgon, but also that a beautiful woman is considered becoming. So there's a double play on the title. You're going to hear the opening of the piece when she's already turned into a gorgon and she's hideous and all the snakes are flying, and then it goes back in time to when she was beautiful.
Nice. Thanks for sharing your music, and I wish you wonderful performances this weekend.
Thank you.
Music of Stacy Garup, Becoming Medusa from her Mythology Symphony. An excerpt from Becoming Medusa from the Mythology Symphony. That was the CCPA Chamber Orchestra conducted by Marklin Thakkar. Conducted, yes. And it's available through Stacy Garup's website, garup.com. More information about Stacy's large work being performed with the San Francisco Choral Society at sfchoral.org. Still to come, a discussion with Peter Robinson, who will muse on the month of November. And we'll hear from one of the prominent cast members, James Snyder, of If Then, which is currently at the Orpheum. Well, the Aurora Theater has an interestingly funny but significantly profound work on its platter right now. It's the company continuing its 24th season with Amy Fried's The Monster Builder. Amy, the playwright, joins me in studio with director Art Mankey to talk about the play at the Aurora. Art, Amy, welcome to KLW.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Architecture as monster builder. I need you to talk about this, Amy, because I think we've all witnessed some architecture that is pretty darn frightening, and that must be the basis of your play. Talk to us about that.
I grew up, my dad was an architect, so I sort of lived firsthand with the architectural mindset. And I grew up as a young person in New York City when that city was going through massive changes. And I've always taken it very personally. And I love cities. I'm a great lover of the urban landscape and the built environment. And when something replaces either neighborhood or nature in a way that I find personally frightening, fierce, repellent, or destructive, or anti-human, I take it as a personal violation.
And who is this monster builder that you've worked the play around, Gregor Zabrowski? Talk to me about
him. Well, I mean, it's not a real architect. I think no architect would identify with him. As my experience with the play is that all architects identify with the young protagonists. It's a tough profession, you know, and people make all kinds of accommodations to the realities of building. Gregor, for me, is kind of a composite of all the worst and most violent trends in building, really since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, and sort of my attempt to put in funny form, as funny as that subject can get, what is responsible? What's the little man behind the curtain of what we see?
What will we see on the stage, Art Mankey, on the Aurora stage?
Well, it's a first of all, a gorgeous cast, if I may say so. An all-star cast from the Bay Area and supremely talented. It's a really, you know, Amy's work is really unique and fun and dynamic and wicked.
Even though it's taking on a very heady subject.
Yeah, it sounds like very heady stuff, but the truth is it's a down and dirty comedy that keeps people rolling in the aisles from start to finish. And there's a lot, you know, a soupçon of sex, if you will, thrown in for good measure. But it's this character, you know, we're all drawn to these evil megalomaniac figures because as an audience we're able to live out our most delicious fantasies by identifying with them. And of course on the opposite end of the spectrum is this young couple that is hell-bent on preserving beautiful old buildings. And of course they come into conflict with the Starkitect, who is attempting to eliminate anything that's human scale and tender.
And this cast that you've assembled, how many folks are going to be part of this stage?
There's six, cast of six, yeah.
And Amy, you, part of the motivation of this work is your love of good architecture. Mm-hmm. What do you consider good architecture versus stuff that's like a monstrosity?
Well, it's a really big conversation. It's an interesting thing. I think there's no one answer to it because I think all genres of architecture have beauty. So what makes good design? What makes alive design? And what makes a design that repels, inhibits, or hurts life is more the question. I think all forms of expression can be beautiful, durable, but it's like, what are the trends that flatten the spirit, make people sick, destroy the cities, create social dysfunction? I mean, we've seen that happen, especially in all the movements of buildings since, you know, the early 20th century. So it's a fascinating thing because it has to do with art, has to do with life, has to do with making people feel like they belong or are highlighted or at the heart of the thoughts of a building, or what makes people feel like they are not the point of a building.
One of the things that we've talked about in rehearsal is that you can stand at a distance and admire the design of a building, admire the dynamic structure, the rule breaking. But how does it feel when you actually walk into the building? Does it oppress you? Or does it lift your spirit and make you want to be there and feel good about life? So that's I think the bigger conversation about design.
Well, it's perfectly timed, I think, given what's going on in San Francisco right now in terms of you don't know what's going to be on that vacant lot 8 months from now unless you've done some research down in City Hall and seen the plans. You see these buildings coming up and they could be beautiful things to see. They could be monstrosities. We just don't know.
Well, it is. And I think, at least from my conversations, this play had a run in Portland last year, and there was a lot of interest in the topic in Portland as well. They've got a riverfront to protect down there, which is going through a lot of change. And a lot of us feel nothing but a cold chill of fear when you hear the words, well, we're going to replace that old town hall. Nobody thinks it's going to be better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nobody. And what is that? What's happened?
I know. I look at some of these buildings myself and I say, where is the creative factor? Well, there's been so much beauty created in architecture. What are these people thinking? How can they get away with that?
Well, it's been a very consistent narrative that has inflected itself through the international style and the idea of functionalism in architecture, which is one thing, but then it went kind of another lap around the track with Philip Johnson and his cohorts in the early 80s, and deconstructivist philosophy and literary deconstruction started inflecting itself through the buildings we've seen, which were anti-narrative. Their purpose has been to dislocate and to create a feeling of disruption and anxiety. That was the actual purpose, that has started working its way into architectural motifs with, I think, it's very hard to admit a mistake on a large scale in terms of ways of thinking or things. It's a big conversation. It's not simple.
Simple, and it's something that audiences recognize, whether they know it or not. You can tell through the laughter that they've experienced it.
I mean, architecture, like so many other things, is a kind of a cyclical thing as well. Do you see something coming back to it? We're not necessarily going to come back to Roman columns and things like that, but do you see something coming back to something more softer?
I wish I could say yes. I don't actually so much, because I think part of what we respond to in older buildings, in the really old buildings, of Europe and other parts of the world, is that they are often created from materials that are indigenous to the area. So there's this primitive kind of connection to the geography of a place. You look at stone, it was quarried nearby. You see the marks of human hands in the building itself. I don't know that we'll find our way back to that again. But I certainly think there are things to be learned about, and I think architects are responding to this, about the sense of the elements in a building rather than the attempt to eradicate all sense of location or elemental. I mean, we look at stone and we feel something from it. Cladding is different. Facades are different than something that comes from the elements of which something were made and that say this is of our place.
Speaking of quarries, the name is escaping me right now, but there's a documentary on Carrara. Where the marble is harvested, and the hand gestures that are involved with moving these huge slabs of marble. I'll have to get that to you. It's supposed to be a fascinating documentary.
Carrara marble plays a significant role in one of our scenes.
It actually does, yes.
Right. Well, I understand some Bach is also featured in the soundtrack. Tell me why the Bach Toccata and Fugue in D minor was chosen.
Well, our title character, the Monster Builder, houses his office in an old Gothic space in the lower Manhattan. And so he's also an organ player. And which leads us into a little bit of the macabre horror movie component of the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it also deals a little bit with our master builder's relationship to all things sacred, which he's drawn to in a kind of a perverse way, I guess. But it's my favorite piece of music for things like that. Mm-hmm.
The play opens this evening at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley, auroratheater.org for more information. Amy Fried, Art Mankey, thanks for coming in and taking a little time with us today.
Thank you
very much.
Music of Johann Sebastian Bach, the Toccata and Fugue in D minor, figuring prominently in Monster Builder at the Aurora Theater by playwright Amy Fried. It's information once again at auroratheater.org. By the way, that was Marie-Claire Alain at the Grand Orgel, the Schwedenkettel de la Collegiale de Saint-Donat, recorded in 1970 on that Arato release. Good afternoon once again. David LaTulipe with you for Open Air. Well, the new contemporary musical If Then is now at the Orpheum here in San Francisco, having enjoyed some 400 or so performances on Broadway. The music is by Tom Kitt with book and lyrics by Brian Yorkie, and it's directed by Michael Greif, who this team is now reunited. They were behind the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning musical Next to Normal. This touring cast features several of the Broadway headliners in the biggest font, featuring Tony Award winner and Broadway superstar Idina Menzel, known from her John Travolta mangled name at the infamous 2014 Tony Awards. How he got Adele Dazeem out of that name is still a mystery.
Oh, yeah,
she's also the star of Wicked, Rent, the voice of Elsa singing Let It Go in Frozen, and on TV as part of the cast of Glee. James, I guess large font's appropriate.
I think it's quite appropriate. Quite, yeah.
Also in the cast, Tony Award winner LaChance. Maybe I'm mangling her
name. Yeah, LaChance. You're doing great.
And Anthony Rape? No, Rap. Also star in this production, as does my guest, in slightly smaller font, but no less beautiful a voice.
Right. Well, technically, according to my contract, about the same.
All right.
That's what
In addition to his role as Josh in If Then, James was seen on Broadway in Crybaby, at New York City Encores and the Goodspeed Opera House, as well as at the Kennedy Center on film and TV. James is from Rancho Murrieta, a small town outside of Sacramento, California, and grew up a self-proclaimed band geek.
Mm-hmm.
Later went to USC, where he sang in the SoCal Vocals, USC's premier a cappella group, quite a group there, while continuing to geek out on productions like the hit stage adaptation Patrick Gorman's Star Wars trilogy in 30 Minutes. James, welcome back to the Left Coast.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
You know, I have to mention, yes, you are wearing an Empire Strikes Back t-shirt. Looks vintage. Is that vintage?
It's meant to look vintage. if only. Yeah.
And I should mention at your website, jamesnyder.com, there's a fun backstage tour of the Richard Rodgers Theater when you were doing If Then back then.
Yeah.
And we do see some Star Wars. You still got that geeky thing going on with the Star Wars thing.
I can't help it. I think Star Wars was one of those great epic stories from my childhood, and I'm fortunate to see it just grow and grow and get to sort of carry that with me.
Are you one of the types that have already gotten tickets for the December screenings?
I have two small children, so I have to sort of navigate that at this point. So once we figure out the babysitter situation.
I was going to say, find a sitter. You got to find a
sitter. But Anthony Rapp was like, when you go see that, I have to go see that movie with you, sitting next to you, because I think he knows how excited I get, and there's nothing like sharing the joy of something like that with somebody.
Sure. Have you been to up to the Presidio and the Lucas?
You know, we were fortunate that show, Star Wars Trilogy in 30 Minutes. We were part of the unveiling party before they broke ground, I think, or something. We went and performed it for most of LucasArts. And got to go to a cool party. I got to meet George Lucas.
Must have been like puppy dog.
Oh, my God. It was like, and we just happened to, we were all leaving the party like, oh, well, I guess we, and we bumped into him in the parking lot of all places. And he was quite gracious and took pictures with us. And so,
well, did you drop a business card saying, you know, I'm an actor.
Look, you know, yeah.
For that part 12 release.
Yeah, yeah. No, I guess J.J. Abrams might be the guy to ask at this point.
True enough. Yeah. Well, speaking of ambitions, I mean, you're fresh off the Broadway production. Were you in for all 400 performances?
I took a week off for a vacation and had a couple sick days in there. But for the most part, this has been 2 years of my life.
Man.
In a crazy way. It's as an actor, it's like one of those blessings and a curse in a sense of like, wow, I've done this show 400 times. It's a bit like Groundhog Day. But
Back when I was in New York, I had musician friends that were that were in Cats since the beginning. You know, dad bought my house in New Jersey.
Yeah, yeah.
Something you got to do. But you also have to stay fresh every night. That must be a challenge. Is there a particular routine that you go through to say, hey, there's going to be someone in that audience, most likely, that has not seen me do this yet?
Yeah, I mean, and that is the challenge of the actor, and that's the joy of the job, in a sense. And to be working with people who are on that exact same page. I always feel like acting is more, my job is to listen, in a sense, when I'm acting. And so there's always something new. There's always new information around us, even in the same room that is on the same stage. Someone like an actress like Adina is forever herself. And so she brings her life to it. And every day your life's different. Every day I've had something different, whatever I had, you know, for breakfast this morning. Well, let's see what you know.
Let's bring it out.
Yeah, let's see what Bagels and Lox brings to the show later. You know, but really, it's a joy.
So there's obviously an adrenaline factor, but is there something in particular you do that you just say, okay, this is it, and you know, the curtain's up?
I meditate, and so there's, I set a different spot. Once I put the outfit on, and then actually after the first scene, there's a little section really before I feel like the sort of momentum of the show, sort of my character within the arc of this story comes in. And so I sit down with my little, I have a backpack on and I put my duffel on my lap and just listen and sort of clear my mind. There's a meditation to having done a show this many times as well, I just try and stay open and stay listening and really just ask the universe for whatever's going to come my way. Let's see what happens. And then that's when the sense of play gets to come in and say, all right, let's, you know, here we go. And to steal a lyric from the show.
Right. Yeah. Well, terrific job last night. I managed to catch last night's performance.
Thank you.
A terrific, terrific job on it. Now, and speaking of people that for the first time will be seeing you, tell us a little bit the storyline of If Then.
Well, we follow the life of Elizabeth, who shows up back in New York in Madison Square Park. And having gone through a messy divorce, and now she's 39 and stepping back into her life, hopefully, where she left New York as a city planner and really wanting to shape the city and come back and find herself within that. And so... through a simple decision, she bumps into she's meeting up with two friends in Madison Square Park, played one by LaShawn's, who's Kate, and then Anthony Rapp's character, Lucas. And at the beginning of the play, we see her choose to go with one, and she bumps into me, and then the other, she goes with Lucas and takes a phone call and gets a job. And through that, just that simple decision of, you know what, I'm going to go with Kate... her life takes this path, and then, oh, well, I'm going to go with Lucas, and her life takes this path, and then we see those two lives simultaneously just running next to each other, and see her explore business and love and finding herself with these choices that are constantly rolling out and facing her. And
well, it's the reality of life. I mean, I think we've all can identify with one of those if-then moments. If I had only done this, or if I hadn't done that, what's your personal moment of an if-then?
It's so many. I feel like I can trace every moment of every significant place I've ended up, and really being in this show was one of those sort of if-then moments. David Stone, the producer of the show, he happened to come see a production of Carousel that I was doing in Connecticut, because his now husband was best friends with the Jen Gambetes, and he slightly reluctantly came and saw this production of Carousel in Connecticut, and was like, "You need to come audition for my show," which I'd never heard of If Then at that point, and I went, and the song, one of my audition songs, was called "Hey Kid," all about having a kid. And the first time I heard that song, my son was 6 weeks sleeping next to me. So my wife got home, and I was like crying. I was like, "Honey, you have to hear this song." And so it was just kismet that he came to see the show and that I had a baby at the time when I'm auditioning for a guy who's just having a baby. So.
Speaking of that kid, that's your son Oliver, is that
Oliver,
correct?
Yeah, Oliver's 2 and a half now.
Now, theatrically named or just some kind of family connection with Oliver?
It was a little bit more interesting. My wife's very, very artistic as well. She's a fashion designer. And it means bringer of peace also. And I think there was something nice about it. We weren't thinking musical. At the same time, I really couldn't wait till he asked for seconds and we got to sing, you know, Never Before Has a Boy Asked for More.
Nice, nice. Well, congratulations on the new kid. What's that kid's name?
Willa is her name.
Willa, nice.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And she's amazing. She's 15 weeks now. And that Willa Cather, obviously, and my grandfather, William, who passed away, Bill, actually. And I lived in San Jose, actually. Mm-hmm. I was born in San Jose, and my parents met at San Jose State. And so the Bay Area is a very special place for us.
Sure.
And,
Well, the show runs through the 6th of December. Any chance of this going on the road and being well-received in Arizona?
What's funny is David Stone said, he's like, wait till you guys get to Tempe. Like, he's like, believe it or not, like, I guess they have this amazing subscriber base. And he's like, trust me, they are going to love it.
Well, there's kind of an inside joke about that.
A bit of an inside joke.
Tell us about that.
So, Elizabeth, or Adina's character, moved from New York to Phoenix. And, now she's back in New York, and she's like, I have no experience with city planning. He's like, what are you talking about? You were living in Phoenix. And she says, teaching urban planning in Phoenix is like teaching breathing on the moon. So it's...
let's hope the Tempe crowd handles that well.
Look, I hate traffic as much as the next guy, so I think at the end of the day, every city's got you can poke a little fun out of it.
Well, speaking back to your if-then-moment and the Goodspeed Opera House run as Billy Bigelow in Carousel, your big number, Hey Kid, must remind you a lot of the soliloquy that Billy has to sing.
It is 100% a modern-day soliloquy, and a treat, just a treat to get to sing that every night. And having a second child now, it's like double the amount of stuff to draw from.
Well, let's hear that now. Here's Hey Kid from If Then. It's at the Orpheum Theater, starring James Snyder, along with some other singers there. Thanks for coming in, James.
Thank you.
Hey Kid, everyone's waiting on you, Kid. Everyone's wondering what you'll do, Kid. It's true, Kid. Me too, Kid. Hey Kid, we're so excited just to know you'll soon be here. Say Kid, we're both delighted, though that may not seem so clear. But I did my OB rotation, so I know the ins and outs. And you're an act of God's creation, so I'm fine with all the doubts. I'm a doctor and a soldier, I've been shelled and under fire. But Kid, if I say that you don't scare me, I'm a liar. Kid, you did surprise me, though I know the facts of life. Wow, Kid, it terrifies me just to say my pregnant wife. 'Cause Kid, I gotta tell ya, I'm not ready, not a bit. There's this macho act I'll sell ya, well inside I lose my shit. It's not that I don't want you, 'cause I do despite my fears. But Kid, is it true you'll stick around for 18 years? Then the call comes on the iPhone, I grab a cab across town. I find her on the fourth floor and they've got her in the gown. She's never looked less lovely, she's a grump and she's got gas. And the labor's 18 hours, oh my God, Kid, move your ass. Then at last you make your entrance and well, Kid, you're quite a sight. I'll be honest, you're disgusting, but I know that you're all right. Though you're screaming and you're spitting and I can't quite see your charms. They clean you and they clothe you and they put you in my arms. And I realize in an instant that I've known you all along, that I've wanted you forever, that I'll never do you wrong. And whatever this world comes to, and whatever comes our way, I will watch you and protect you. I promise, Kid, we'll be okay. We'll be okay.
Kid from If Then, currently at the Orpheum. That is James Snyder in the starring role, one of the starring roles, shall we say, of If Then. And as promised, a little discussion with Peter Robinson about the month of November. Peter Robinson, our regular contributor to Open Air, joins me now for some musings on the month of November. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And for me, November is very much a month of memories. But first, one way that I get introduced to it is to hike down Tennessee Valley in Marin on a late afternoon, just as the sun is setting, and you'll have no doubts at this time of year that November is here and winter on its way. Already, the days are getting darker earlier, and you often find a crisp offshore wind whistling up the valley as you catch the first sight of the Pacific. But look to your left and look to your right. The hills are now bare, the colours have gone, and in fact I am reminded of four lines of a poem from Thomas Hood called November. No warmth, no cheerfulness, no beautiful ease, no comfortable feel in any member, no shade, no shine, no butterflies, no bees, no fruit, no flower, no leaves, no birds. November. And I think about that on these hikes. And it's not unlike the other nature poet, grumpy old Robert Frost. Not yesterday I learnt to know the love of bare November days before the coming of the snow. But if it were vain to tell her so, and they are better for her praise. Frost had that uncanny ability to write about the interconnectedness between man and nature, and at the same time capture what I call the beauty and leave you not to determine a universal meaning, but to feel you're actually there. Now, as I grew up in England, November the 5th actually meant something called Guy Fawkes Day, harking back to the year 1605, when Guy, who was Guy Fawkes, planned to blow up the House of Lords on the day that James I scheduled to open Parliament. And it gives rise to a local folktale, Remember, Remember, the 5th of November. And as a rhyme, the kids would recite it, and there would indeed be bonfires around the city. It was bonfire night, with firecrackers and guys, or effigies of guys, lit up. But for others, November opens with All Souls Day and the Day of the Dead, which also means another form of remembrance. Finally comes the celebrated close of the end of the First World War, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month at Armistice Day, November 1918. Although it wouldn't be until 1954 that Veterans Day was actually added to the calendar. In Europe, this is referred to as Poppy Day, when people wear poppies in their coat lapels in remembrance of the fallen. These poppies bloomed across some of the worst battlefields of Flanders in the First World War, and their brilliant colour was an appropriate symbol of the blood spilled. So there are many reasons the month of November is a month of memories. Many of them when remembrance of the dead conjures up moments of the past, but they still mark turning points in history. The month finishes with Thanksgiving Day, first proclaimed as a national holiday in the United States by President George Washington on November the 26th, 1789. As a presidential month, five American presidents were born in November: James Polk, Zachary Taylor, Franklin Pierce, Warren Harding, and James Garfield. Abraham Lincoln delivered his Gettysburg Address on November the 19th, 1863, and perhaps most tragic date in recent history, November the 22nd, 1963, when President Kennedy was assassinated. Perhaps the word bleak best describes a month. Emily Dickinson concluded, "November always seemed to me the Norway of the year." Ah, yes, she is writing before the shopping spree of Black Friday. But hang on, we're only just coming out of a recession, so maybe let's go back and settle for the word bleak. Bleak November.
Thank you, Peter, for those musings on the month of November. That's Open Air for this week. I'm David LaTulipe. My thanks to Neil Swinkels for producing Open Air, and I'm encouraging you to take a roll in the hay this weekend for the Circus Center Cabaret's next show, A Roll in the Hay, with Roger Glenn Trio providing the music. You can romp, frolic, and play at the Circus Center Cabaret Friday and Saturday at the Circus Center on Frederick Street.